All right.
Hello. So yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I think I've given a very, not very, but quite similar talk to this before. So for those who have seen that already, get open your laptops. But yeah, so thanks a lot for the opportunity. And I've given this title to this talk, but I really want to talk about some. So the general picture of going beyond our current understanding of the standard cosmological paradigm, and some smart ways of doing that. Small scale signatures ends up being a very good candidate to do this. But I'll actually mention a number of things. So these are the collaborators. Some of them are here. I'm gonna so they've also seen this talk a number of times. So I apologize to them as well. And this did, so this in this slide I show some of the projects that I've been interested in the past few months. So it looks like a bit of everything. To be honest, to me, it does actually feel like I'm doing quite similar things. That there are enough similarities between all of these projects that I in fact feel like I'm doing more or less the same thing for all of these. But in general, I'm interested in early or late time effects, and especially utilizing the statistical anisotropies to come out with different probes. And the general motivation of my interest in this is always the fundamental physics. So the question is how come we can constrain fundamental physics, what kinds of tools and measurements we can do in an effective way. So I'll be talking about the moving lens effect most of the talk, which is in collaboration with a lot of people from. Has now become a big program, or at least becoming a big program for the upcoming large-scale observations of the CMB and large-scale structure. But I'll also talk about some primordial phenomenological models and how one can utilize something like this to constrain those. And also, I'll mention a few things about the 21 centimeter as well, which I find quite exciting. So you can stop and ask me questions at any time. So I'll say a few more words about the whole motivation for these lines of studies. I'll, in some order, go through these bullet points. So I'll describe some future directions in probably at the beginning and also at the end. I'll discuss the CMB secondaries that most of us are interested in and working on, and the prospects of detecting these. And I'll say a few words about the prospects of studying physics beyond the standard lambda CDM, which is the cosmological paradigm. In particular, I'll be talking about the primordial compensated isocurvature. So that's the outline of the talk. So here are some motivation slides. So far with the existing experiments, the WMAP, the Planck, the BOS, the DES, we have a very good understanding of the standard cosmological model that is the lambda CDM that gives us the matter and the baryon densities, the curvature of the universe, the age, all these kind of things, as well as the sort of characteristics of initial fluctuations that they are Gaussian, close to scale invariant, and adiabatic. But with the future experiments, we will actually gonna be doing much better, and there are tons of remaining questions, of course, involving the sort of the light mediators between, for example, like dark sector particles, dark photons, weakly interacting light particles. These are all going to be affecting the growth of structures, so we can do much better in constraining these and understanding the physics beneath them. As well as dark energy, dark matter, inflation, and all these kind of things. And we can also start understanding the deviations from Gaussian scale invariant and adiabatic conditions, which I'm all interested in, and been doing projects in somehow touching almost all of these items so far. Oh yeah, and of course there are these tensions as well. So we might be interested in tensions, like the Hubble tension. I'll say a few words about this as well. And so the upcoming decade really seems like it's going to be populated by all of these large experiments, trying to get better understanding of all of these remaining questions that are somewhat fundamental most of the time. All right, but as a CMB scientist, or have been focused on CMB for so long, I will be focusing on CMB most of the time in this talk as well. So this is the observed CMB so far. We do quite well with all the scales almost. The signal to noise is quite good. And the primary CMB is quite well measured. So going beyond the primary CMB, one can ask what remains to be measured or what's not measured so well. One example is of course the very large scales. So these very large scales are cosmic variance limited in the sense that we have only one universe, we can only make so many modes. So if we want to constrain some sort of physics up there, we will not have that many independent observables to constrain that, so we'll have a large uncertainty in our model, essentially measurements. And this is our cosmic variance. But these large scales are actually very, very valuable, very, very useful for constraining fundamental physics, in particular because of the equivalence principle. Because the local physics does not care what the gravitational potential is, local interactions cannot produce fluctuations that scale like the potential itself. They scale like the Laplacian of the potential or the time derivative of the potential, and this induces extra factors of k, which in turn means that when you go to very, very small scales, it will be unlikely that you can sort of create physics that is correlated on very large scales, having an observational impact on large scales. So small scale nonlinear physics is somewhat so the large scales are undisturbed by the very small scale nonlinear physics, so that makes the large scales a very good observable for fundamental models, constraining fundamental models. But of course it's really hard to get access to these kind of models, and it turns out that the way to do this is as follows. So the upcoming experiments such as the CMB stage 4 but also SO, we'll see a very small scale CMB quite well. So we will go up to like 6,000, even more for the CMB stage 4. And in those scales, CMB will be essentially dominated by the secondaries. The secondaries are second order perturbation effects. These are like, maybe I have a picture here. These are as shown there, the lens, lensing or the kinetic Snell-Doge effect I'll mention in a second. But it turns out that these very small scale measurements, these very small scale observables, have a lot of information about the very, very large scales. So upcoming opportunity with these CMB observations is actually utilizing this information in these very, very small scales for the purpose of fundamental physics. Here are some pictures of these secondaries. I'll be mentioning a few of them in some detail. But of course, there are other things, not only the larger scales that can be used effectively to search for fundamental physics. Some other things are also there. For example, the BAO feature and the morphology of it is quite sensitive to various types of things that are quite fundamental in its nature. For example, effective number of neutrino-like species, the light weakly coupled species have a distinct imprint on these things, as well as sort of primordial isocurvature, which I'll actually talk about in a minute. But the CMB and the BAO feature itself from the galaxy fluctuation galaxy distribution is well understood and explored. But in the remaining of this talk, when I'm done with the CMB, I think I will be able to say a few words about an additional observable that are the velocity acoustic oscillations that is observed on the hydrogen, 21 centimeter hydrogen line, which itself is also a candidate to be an interesting probe for fundamental physics. So I'll come back to this later in the talk. So here are some very sort of simple things about the CMB physics. A CMB photon, of course, traverses through the entire universe before it comes and hits our telescopes. It gets deflected by gravitational lenses on its way. It gets scattered on electrons on energetic clusters, hot clusters of gas, it can get thermal. So there are thermal Sinyar-Zaldovich effects and kinetic Sinyar-Zaldovich effects due to depending on the velocities of these electrons as well. It can also get so the kinetic Sinyar-Zaldovich effect is actually well studied here. is a big program here. It is essentially the projection of the remote dipole that the electron sees onto the line of sight, and it looks a bit like this. So this is from a simulation. It turns out that in very, very small scales, CMB will be dominated by the KSC effect. Essentially, all you'll be observing by looking at the CMB will be KSC. So this is also an important observable. CMB photon can also get redshifted, of course, due to evolving potentials. So these are effects called the Sachs-Wolfe effect or Ishiyama effect. And in the remainder of the talk, this looks like a bit like this. So as the CMB photon goes through, the potential evolves, and it gets redshifted or blue shifted depending on the gate choice. And I will be talking about for the rest of this talk on this other thing, which is related, of course, that is the moving lens effect that we worked on recently. Okay, so imagine a gravitational potential that is moving transverse to the line of sight. It turns out in this picture, a CMB photon that gets scattered into the observer's line of sight ends up being modulated by this term here. It is a sort of a dot product between the transverse velocities and this angle beta. And if you solve the geodesic equation, this angle beta ends up being related to the gravitational potential. I will say that in a minute. And this particular dipole, dot product structure is very similar to ordinary lensing, where the effect there is the dot product between the gradient of the temperature and this alpha, which is the lensing deflection angle. And one can represent this as a sort of a pure gradient on very large scales, which we can do the same for this moving lens potential as well. All right. But in its essence, it's actually an analogous to ISW effect, which is the time integral of the time evolution of the gravitational potential on the line of sight. So it looks like this, as you would know. And the time derivative we can always write as the velocity dot the gradient of the gravitational potential. And this is precisely what this beta angle is. It's the integral over the gradient of the gravitational potential on the line of sight. So in turn, the effect on the CMB ends up looking a bit like this. That is the line integral of the dot product between the transverse velocities and the gradient of the gravitational potential. So it is more sensitive to the transverse part of the velocities on the account that the perpendicular velocities will get V over C correction when you boost back to the CMB rest frame. And it will be subdominant. So the transverse velocities actually give the dominant effect for this particular effect. And overall, it's very similar to lensing in the sense that it has a very similar effect, the deflection angle with a different time kernel, essentially. So this is what we call the moving lens effect. It looks like this. It's a dipolar modulation around the gravitational potential that's aligned with the transverse velocity of the gravitational potential. Where the photon gets blue shifted or red shifted depending on your gate choice. But also, this picture, so this can also be seen in the rest frame of the gravitational lens as the lensing of the kinematic dipole. You can also interpret it as that too. All right. So this is how it looks like on a larger larger scale, and this is how it looks like on the entire universe. So at redshift 1.4, so you can see all of these little dipolar modulations having a total imprint over the sky.
So I guess what you really are calculating is psi dot, not v dot grad, because the ISW effect or Ishiyama effect is integral of psi dot, right?
Particularly for this plot, because you see there's a large gradient. Yeah, this plot has a linear term in it. But we're more interested in the nonlinear part, the small scale contribution.
Is this integral of psi dot or is this phi dot grad?
This is integral of phi dot here. Okay. There is a term that is essentially a linear term in phi as well here. So that's what you see as a large gradient.
The other contribution is like when you have collapsing halos, then that also gives you nonlinear phi dot, which is not due to motion, it's just due to nonlinear collapse. Basically.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we're more interested in reconstructing the velocity fields.
So here you have everything.
Yeah, here there's both of those effects going on. All right, so is this detectable? Is the next question. So the way to go around detecting this is also in this particular way is also very intuitive. What the underlying reason is for this effect is actually writing a quadratic estimator. So what we have done here is writing an estimator of the velocity field, the transverse velocity field on very large scales using maps of CMB and large scale structure on very small scales. So this can be done because of the following reason. A large-scale velocity mode, in turn, essentially locally redistributes how the galaxies are correlated with the temperature. So this power between the cross-correlations of temperature and the galaxies are redistributed in the presence of a large velocity mode, in turn gives a non-zero squeeze by spectrum. And then we can use this to essentially reconstruct the large-scale velocity mode from the small-scale statistical anisotropy induced by that. So that's the procedure of quadratic estimator. This is schematically how it looks like. We produce the velocity field using the modes of CMB and galaxies, and it's also quite similar to ordinary lensing, where one uses the two CMBs, and similarly for the KSC effect too, where one uses one tries to reconstruct the radial velocity mode from the galaxy distributions of galaxy and the CMB maps. All right, so this is a signal to noise plot of the moving lens effect shown with the RMS of the CMB experiments for at least CMB stage 4 in Simon's observatory highlighted in cross correlations with the galaxy surveys LSST and DES. And it looks like for the upcoming experiments for Simon's Observatory and CMB Stage 4, moving lens effect will be detected to quite high significance. And in fact, for this kind of significance, one becomes motivated to ask the question, what can we do with these reconstructed velocity fields? So here I'm showing the signal expected from the transverse velocity with the reconstruction noise on this for CMB stage 4-like experiment and an SO-like experiment cross-correlated with LSST. And it looks like we're going to be able to reconstruct modes up to L around 10, 20. So this is quite optimistic and good. Because as you see from here, the reconstruction noise for this velocity-induced effects essentially acts to be constant in velocity. So it's like a shot noise in velocity. So if I'm trying to then constrain something that essentially depends on or trying to constrain fluctuations in the density perturbations, this gives me a noise that scales like L square, as you can see from here. The red line. This means that on very, very large scales, I do much, much better in terms of signal to noise if I was to try to constrain some physics. So this has been utilized to constrain non-Gaussianity, for example, and it is one of the most promising tools to do this. So here you see the KSC reconstructed velocity forecast.
Sorry, have you tested this on simulations, or the one that you were showing me, or is this just analytic?
So this KSC reconstruction, I don't know if necessarily this group here tested this on simulations, the pipeline itself, have you?
No, I'm not sure that's not.
I'm working on it.
They're working on this.
But you said the moving lens, okay, so I guess, I'm confused. Where is the moving lens effect?
Yeah. So here, there's no moving lens
effect.
Okay.
I guess I'm just worried that, I mean, can you distinguish moving lens effect from like other nonlinear effects that affect phi dot? That's the question.
Right, that's a great question. And this is something we're definitely interested in.
And you have the simulation, I guess, because you were showing me the simulation. So in principle, you could...
Right. Well, in particular, for the moving lens effect, we're interested in this dipolar shape, right? So we're kind of interested in this particular pattern that happens in the presence of these velocity fields. So a dot like so essentially, velocity is projected on the gradient of the gravitational potential. Like that will be what we're sensitive to. So it's a great question to think about what other things produce these. So in terms of nonlinear ISW type effects, like other things that goes into that, I'm not sure how exactly to answer that question just yet. But we can also, for example, conjecture like things like ordinary lensing would also have similar biases in the whole reconstruction. And I can talk more about that later. But we have been testing those, but not so far with simulations, more like. But yeah, so simulations are happening.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the moving lens contribution to the nonlinear ISW effect dominates in the squeeze limit that Salim is interested in. So Riis-Yama is another contribution to nonlinear ISW, but that's not going to contribute to these squeeze triangles that is supposed to.
But I mean, I guess it would be nice to confirm that in simulation.
From that on pencil and paper.
Right.
It's right in analytically, and that is true.
Right, so if simulation doesn't match, it's a problem with the simulation.
Well, I'm not sure. Could be a problem with pencil and paper because you cannot do everything on paper. So like, that's what I'm wondering. So you have two things to agree to be sure.
Yeah. No, I do agree. One can always do more tests. All right, so the whole goal beneath this whole program of coming out with more probes of large-scale fluctuations is, of course, fundamental physics and essentially trying to constrain fundamental physics. So one observable that is very useful for this reason is the galaxy bias, which in turn ends up being scale invariant in the absence of non-local effects from primordial non-local effects such as non-Gaussianity. But in the presence of non-Gaussianity, there ends up being a scale dependence on very large scales on the galaxy bias, the bias that relates the matter distribution to the distribution of halos or galaxies. But the problem with this kind of observable is that, again, at these very large scales, we're necessarily cosmic variance limited, and there's not that many modes that we can test against such that we can tell a small deviation from the model prediction in the absence of this type of effect. So one way around this, actually, is to use the relative biases of two tracers, which itself also will pick up a scale dependence. And doing this, we can actually go beyond the sample variance. And this is called the sample variance cancellation. And again, this is one of the most promising tools to constrain large-scale cosmological models and deviations from the standard paradigm. And in this case, we can use velocity fields that is produced from measurements of moving lens effect, along with a tracer of the density fields, such as galaxy surveys. And the ratio, the relative bias of these will pick up a scale dependence, and we can use this scale dependence to constrain our fundamental physics. So primordial non-Gaussianity is explored. Recently, we worked on this other thing, that is the primordial isocurvature, which I want to talk about now as some candidate of what might be interesting going after various fundamental signatures. And I will talk about how primordial isocurvature also leads to a scale-dependent bias. But before, let me essentially advocate the study of primordial isocurvature, so some general motivation for this. So the field equations in cosmology ends up having at least two solutions that are adiabatic. If the early universe such as it has only one degree of freedom, such as a single field inflation, there's only two solutions and both of them are adiabatic. So this kind of model naturally predicts purely adiabatic fluctuations. But if you have theories with multiple degrees of freedom, then you can source isocurrential fluctuations, non-adiabatic fluctuations. So any observation, like an ambiguous observation of primarily isocurrential will definitely mean that there are other degrees of freedom. And it's quite interesting. So here is, so in the presence of isocurvature, then, so in the absence of isocurvature, what adiabatic fluctuations mean is that any perturbation to the force scalar, such as energy distributions of any constituent, any species in the universe, such as baryons, cold dark matter, and neutrinos, divided by their mean value is essentially same for all the species in the universe, and that's an adiabatic system. But in the presence of isocurvature, then these baryons, cold dark matter, and neutrinos, they all act as independent degrees of freedom. And this is how it looks like. So these I show here some cold dark matter isocurvature contributions to the CMB observables on the left side and to the matter density, so matter power spectrum on the right side, and you can see at least for the matter power spectrum, it's sort of a very observable effect of isocurvature, the generic form of cold dark matter isocurvature here. So one observation here is that isocurvature modes are essentially has a different phase. They're in average shifted by a pi over two difference in their phase. So in the presence of isocurvature, what ends up happening is essentially you end up pushing. So you end up making an effect that is similar to decreasing the Hubble parameter. So recently we have realized that actually this can be worked on to in relation to this Hubble tension. In the presence of isocurvature, it mimics the effect of reducing the Hubble parameter. If you put more isocurvature, in turn you would want the larger Hubble parameter. Can primordial small-scale isocurvature explain Hubble tension? If you're interested, then just hang on. It looks like actually it might, and which is kind of interesting. But I won't be interested in that the generic forms of cold dark matter isocurvature are as such. But I will be interested in this other class of models that are compensated isocurvature perturbations. So these are, from a particle physics point of view, I think I'll mention in a second, they're not necessarily very natural, but they are like one of the last frontiers of weird things that we cannot really constrain. It turns out that in the presence of compensated isocurvature perturbations, where the isocurvature perturbations of baryons compensate fully the isocurvature perturbations of dark, cold dark matter in a way that the total fluctuations, the fluctuations of total matter in the universe is still adiabatic, it turns out that this type of isocurvature is really, really hard to constrain. That is because CMB at the leading order is only affected by the total matter distributions. So the compensated isocurvature perturbations do not have any effect on the CMB, on leading order. So one can only constrain these going to higher orders in the CMB. And the constraints so far with the current observations are allow these types of isocurvature fluctuations to be 500 times larger than the adiabatic fluctuations. So the fluctuation budget, in the early universe can all be isocurvature, and we have no idea about it. Especially this is true for the Curwitan decay case, where you have a an additional degree of freedom during inflation, which then comes to dominate the curvature fluctuations upon its decay. And when this happens, if it decays into cold dark matter and baryons in an uneven way, or in a way that produces these compensated isocurvature perturbations, you can have this effect. Now, because it's sourced non-locally, it scales like the gravitational potential, the curvature compensated isocurvature perturbations, which in turn also produces a galaxy bias that we might go after. So it's a very similar type of effect that non-Gaussianity produces, essentially. And we can ultimately try to constrain this by trying to look at the deviations and the galaxy bias. So recently we've done this. The current constraints from future CMB measurements forecasted to be around 10, so it still allows like 10 times larger Isaac curvature perturbations. Whereas, for example, moving using something like the moving lens effect already gives you better constraints on this class of models.
So you're putting in density fluctuations in the ions and dark matter in a way that traces the large scale potential. Is that what you're saying? Or the curvature? Yes.
Yeah, it traces the So whatever the source is, the large scale potential, like curvature perturbations, in the case of inflation. They then scale like the potential, so they have like the potential factor.
Okay, but the density fluctuations, so in the variance in dark matter, ultimately are tracing the potential fluctuations. So, okay.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, you decay into, yeah, essentially density of dark matter and particles.
Right. But you're getting like the FNL effect just because you're tracing the potential.
Yeah.
I see.
So in a recent work, we used the KSC effect, which in turn actually does even an order of magnitude better in constraining this, and by which we get a constraint on the amplitude of these Isaac curvature perturbations that's of around 0.5. So it's like two orders of magnitude better than the constraints from the current. Three orders of magnitude better than the current observations, and still an order of magnitude over an order of magnitude better than the future observations of the CMB. So this is just to show that the this is just to show that the Isaac curvature so these small scale perturbations, in turn reconstructed large scale fluctuations, are a very good tool to constrain these type of models. All right, so let me say a few more words about what might be other effective ways of searching for fundamental physics that are somewhat underexplored at the moment. And these are related to the BAO feature. Of course, dark matter and baryons have very different equations of motion. Baryons are coupled to photons in the early universe. And they fluctuate around gravitational waves, wells, inducing very distinct BAO features in our observables. And this particular BAO feature is essentially sensitive to the speed of sound, so the baryon content in wherever you're looking in the universe. So these CIPs, the compensated Isaac curvature perturbations, in turn essentially sort of shift the amount of dark matter, like the ratio between the dark matter, cold dark matter, and baryons in the universe, spatially, right? So if you look at here, you're going to have a different ratio between cold dark matter and baryons. You're going to have a different ratio between cold dark matter and baryons there. So the BAO feature itself will have a different speed of sound, and this will be reflected exactly on the BAO. So if you look at, for example, the BAO peak from galaxy surveys, you know, at a place in the universe where this compensated Isaac curvature is large and positive, it will have a particular effect that is distinctly different than the effect on a place in the universe where this compensated Isaac curvature is large and negative. So this can be utilized to then constrain Isaac curvature perturbations as well, so the imprint on the BAO. So you go produce BAO BAO feature reconstruction on different boxes in the universe. In doing so, you sort of produce these BAO peaks, and then you essentially sort of study the statistics of these to tell whether if there is an additional contribution from something primordial that shift these throughout the whole universe. It turns out that this is not a more optimistic way of constraining this compensated Isaac curvature perturbations than, for example, the moving lens effect. It's actually comparable to the CMB. So the constraints one gets from doing this analysis ends up being very similar to what one gets from the CMB analysis. But nevertheless, it is kind of interesting, and it's suggestive that the that these kind of probes can be very useful for constraining these types of physics. So here, let me motivate another feature, which is essentially due to the very same physics, that is the VAO oscillation. So the 21 centimeter line is 21 centimeter line is essentially due to, so the ground state of neutral hydrogen has two spin flip states, a triplet and a singlet, and a transition from one to the other either emits or absorbs a photon, facilitated by an emission or an absorption of a photon. And so this is related to the spin flip like temperature of the 21 so the hydrogens, and one can take compare this to the background CMB temperature to produce temperature brightness essentially observables throughout the universe. In particular, what I'm interested in is the VAO features, in particular this power spectrum of the brightness spectrum from the dark ages or dark eras. So these are redshifts around 20, so very early times. But at these times, also these VAO features are very prominent. So as you can see, for a particular feedback model that's shown here, they are order one. It's quite distinctively obvious in the power spectrum. So this can be an interesting tool to use for fundamental physics, in particular because as the nature of these oscillations, the various characteristics of the oscillations, such as the location of the peaks or the separation of the peaks, so the scale, is actually very independent of the baryonic uncertainties that come with how you model your feedback and things like this. So you can see here a number of different baryonic feedback models, all actually produce essentially have the same peak locations independently of their complicated sort of models. So this itself produces so suggests that this is a very effective observable to identify where those peak locations are and to search for the types of effects that are primordial and that change those peak locations or the speed of sound, in turn changing the these acoustic scales throughout the universe. Yeah, go.
This is the velocity power spectrum?
No, this is the brightness temperature of the hydrogen line.
How does this translate to velocities? VAO?
So essentially it's just star formation. So in the presence of large relative velocities between dark matter and the baryons, it acts like a gas pressure inside a halo, kicking out baryons. So it like suppresses star formation. And so that's what you see here as an imprint of that.
It's just like this paper by Celia Lakovich and Toronto.
Oh yeah, this is it's exactly that. Sorry, I didn't say that. Anil, obviously.
I guess the idea is that the velocity is supersonic velocities affect the star formation, so you don't actually see velocities directly, but they imprint the velocities.
Sure. And
that's why I guess the size of the effect is model dependent, because your model I guess translates somehow the relative velocity into some impact on the star formation and then impact on the 21 centimeter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
this is something that would not be a normal perturbation theory. Like when you calculate the VAO of densities, then you would miss this effect of the star formations.
So this is one of the second order terms.
Yeah.
Which Sydakovich pointed out.
Okay, and this is just unexpectedly large, this term, or?
Maybe not for everyone.
So VAO is a first order effect.
Yeah.
This is second order.
Yeah, it's essentially squared. So the relative velocity square is what's producing this effect. It's second order in relative velocities. it doesn't come out with. So far, like existing simulation tools and whatnot had not had like this particular effect in place. It's now only been recognized.
The other effect is much larger than the first order effect. Is that fine?
Well, yeah, it has a huge imprint on star formation. I mean, it's a mean field like approach. You essentially
calculate the power spectrum of 21 centimeter at high redshift, and I would not.
It's star formation.
The second order effect, then it would be much too small. Is that right? So I get much more if I take into account this effect. Does that not make sense? Neil looks confused.
I'd be surprised if this is large compared to just like normal BAO.
What do you mean normal BAO?
Just like the regular, you know, Barragán acoustic oscillations in the matter power spectrum.
Well, I guess the normal BAO does not have an effect on. Well, yeah, so this completely goes away in the absence of taking into account the relative velocities. So these are entirely induced by relative velocities.
But I mean, the 21 centimeter power spectrum at high redshift must have BAO something, right?
But I think that the idea...
I mean, star formation is essentially what is...
Usually,
this is sense.
Versus galaxies. Galaxies trace matter, and matter has the BAO.
Yeah, but you... Right. But then star formation gets, like, very impacted by the relative velocities.
In your model?
Yes. Well...
Who knows? I mean...
In real world, nobody knows.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that's the same. Right.
But I think that the idea is that a lot of scholars usually think that galaxies follow matter density, but this hypothesizes that there is also a component that follows velocities, not just matter density. So that's
the relative velocity.
The relative velocity, right?
Yeah.
So it's at the linear level, it's a different component. It's not just
the amount of phase.
Yeah, it changes the phases and everything. And yeah, if this is a big effect, if it's not a big effect, then yeah.
Because there was this paper, something like a new standard ruler, right? By Moon.
Yeah, by this guy.
Right. And that was like a big thing of her. Like there was a lot of, I saw a lot of like, it was on physics.org and so on. I was just wondering if the BAO is a standard ruler that would be there anyway, right? I was just wondering whether this effect would be larger or whether, what does it capture that the BAO in 21 centimeter does not have? Okay, go ahead. I was just
right, yeah, so it appears to be order one compared to BAO. So yes, where BAO is...
Similar sized as the BAO, right? Order one compared to BAO.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was thinking of maybe CMB in terms of like less sensible for this. All right, so one thing that we are working on is essentially doing the same CIP analysis, box sort of box by box in the universe, taking into account the relative velocities and the 21 centimeter observable. So this being a large effect, well, arguably a large effect on the 21 centimeter brightness temperature, one can go to different locations of the sky, see whether if the acoustic scale, the BAO scale, changes more than you'd expect from your modeled parameter, and then try to get a constraint on these isochroic perturbations. And it turns out to be actually quite promising. Some preliminary statements could be that it is as promising as the BAO, but likely better. It appears so as well, depending on your experiment forecast. So this is upcoming work, but this is just to suggest that if true, and if large, the BAO oscillations can also be utilized and facilitated to constrain interesting primordial physics, such as these type of isochroic perturbations. You don't agree?
It's entirely model dependent.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess if you just completely kill.
To expect star formation to strongly trace this relative velocity, right?
But you'll expect to find types of things that will be independent of the type of baryonic or star formation effects that can change the amplitude, for example, but not the phase, essentially.
Yeah, but there's no reason to expect this amplitude to be not zero, as I'm saying.
Right.
Yes.
Oh yeah, the question then is, what is the reasonable range of numbers that goes into play? Right. Okay, yes, so I think that was my last slide. So yeah, so here are some conclusions. So I think I've tried to motivate that with the upcoming surveys of CMB and Galaxy, so CMB measurements and Galaxy surveys, and also with the 21 centimeter line, they're like exciting opportunities to go after fundamental physics, more so the small scale statistical anisotropies. These can be utilized to constrain fundamental physics. But perhaps velocity induced acoustic oscillations as well in 21 centimeter,
which
is ongoing work. So thank you.
Before we take questions for Salim, we're going to have a speaker dinner at 5:30 in the bistro for anyone who would like to join us.
5:30?
He needs to go to Toronto tonight,
oh,
so
okay.
5:30. Get questions. I have a question.
Right.
So if you go back to the slide where you showed the imprint of CIPs on the density field. Going back, that one. All right, so is the thing you're calling VAO the BBC delta BC term in this equation, or is it the term that is neglected here, which is argued to be small, that's a bias times the velocity?
Right. So I have been assuming it's the second, like the first thing you said.
It's just this delta BBC.
Yeah, the delta BBC, yeah.
Okay.
Wait, sorry, what? Like the VA, like the VAO or the, sorry.
So this,
when I get to
this effect has two contributions. One of them comes from this term here, the bias times the relative density of dark matter and baryons. And another one that comes from bias times the relative velocity of dark matter and baryons.
Uh-huh.
I'm just curious which one of those two things is responsible for the plots that we saw later.
Like those VAO plots.
Yeah.
This thing you're calling VAO, I believe, has these two terms in the density. It gives rise to two terms in the density. That's my understanding.
Oh, sorry, you were asking for the actual plots that,
yeah,
that are not produced by me.
This is a density you're showing us. So is that density coming from bias times delta BC, or is it coming from bias times relative velocity?
So these fluctuations,
yeah,
themselves. So I think. So then it is coming from the delta VC.
For sure. Yeah. Okay.
So for these ones. On top of that, if you add, for example, for a given model, the delta, the large delta BC, to times the bias BC, then you get something like this as well. So they're like similar effects. Yeah, yes.
So it's a very weird thing because it's like there are two spheres here. One is this VAO effect, unknown amplitude, and the other is this compensated isocurvature,
right,
with unknown amplitude. And I guess you want to have both of them and see how combination of the two affect things. And I don't know if it's easy, you know, I mean, is that a new parameter that had these two work together?
So the unknown parameter in the VAO effect, as far as I understand, it's beyond just the baryonic feedback modeling. But to me, so far I've been arguing that it was only the baryonic feedback, which itself acts as like changing the amplitude itself, but for example does not change the speed of sound and things like this prior. So the peak locations themselves do not change, for example.
But I mean, the question is, this VAO, if people go do simulations, they do it with adiabatic perturbations.
Yeah.
So they have to do a different set of simulations with compensated isocurvature perturbations to get new set of parameters, right?
To make the statement that it's
okay.
To make such statements, it will have to be like that.
Other questions?